This is Decisions and Dilemmas, a podcast for the Center for Ethics at the University of Toronto. Welcome to the first episode of Decisions and Dilemmas, a new podcasting series for the Center for Ethics at the University of Toronto. Today is Friday, December 20th, 2011, and I'm your host, Timothy Walker. On today's episode, I sit down with Professor Alan Brudner from the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto to examine the topic of crime and punishment. Thank you, Professor Brudner, for sitting down and talking to me today. I want to ask you some questions regarding crime and punishment in general, I guess. To most people, it seems obvious when someone does something wrong, they should be punished. I guess many would be surprised to learn that there's anything mysterious about this or that legal experts disagree about why punish people. Could you describe the major schools of thought on this and where your own work fits into this debate?
Sure, I'd be happy to. While it may be obvious to most people that people should be punished for wrongdoing, it's not obvious to philosophers, because I suppose nothing is obvious to philosophers. So there are a number of schools of thought here. One holds that we're determined to act in the way we do by instinct, by natural laws. And of course, if you subscribe to that view of determinism, it makes no sense to punish people for wrongdoing, because they're not responsible for their wrongdoing. It makes sense only to try to prevent them from causing harm again. And so the whole institution of punishment then goes by the board, and instead we're talking about psychological conditioning, trying to associate causing injury with pain instead of pleasure. You might think of the device that was used in the Stanley Kubrick film, A Clockwork Orange, right? So that's one point of view, a deterministic point of view, which would reject the whole institution of punishment altogether in favor of psychological conditioning. But even if one is not a determinist, one might still think that punishing people for their wicked actions is outmoded, that it belongs to an uncivilized era where we thought we could, there was nothing problematic in judging people for their wickedness, and indeed nothing problematic with determining whether people are wicked and how wicked they are. So you might think that punishing people, sort of a whole punitive approach to the criminal law, is outmoded, civilized, even if you're not a determinist. And so you would think that a more civilized approach to the criminal law would be prevention rather than punishment. And so you wouldn't care any longer, for example, whether anyone was responsible for his or her actions, right? If a person caused injury to someone, then you would simply convict on that basis, that he caused injury, and then whether or not he was responsible would be relevant only in determining what sort of preventive measures are needed now going forward.
So also in that part, you could maybe include rehabilitation or something as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Rehabilitation, prevention. Yeah. Rehabilitation is a way of preventing this person from doing it again.
Right.
So even from that point of view, you would be concerned with responsibility, not at the conviction stage, but at the sentencing stage, with determining what sort of measures are needed to prevent this person doing it again. And so even here, the institution of punishment goes by the board once again, because what we're really doing is that we're not really punishing people within this perspective. We're just managing human threats, right? Institution for civilly committing the insane were just applied across the board to deal with all potential human threats. So the institution of punishment then just disappears into an administrative scheme for dealing with human threats. That's one point of view. Now, even within the camp of those who think that we ought to punish people for their criminal actions, we can, again, distinguish between a number of schools. We can distinguish between, most broadly, between consequentialist theorists of punishment and retributive theorists of punishment. So a consequentialist would say that the point of punishment is forward-looking. It's to, once again, to prevent crime, to deter others, to protect society against dangerous people, and to rehabilitate the criminal. That point of view, that consequentialist justification of punishment, I think collapses into the kind of approach I spoke to before, that is the approach that collapses punishment into just an administrative scheme for managing threats. Because if you think that punishment is justified by its good effects, then you will probably weaken the desert constraints on pursuing your favorite goals, right? You would weaken the requirement, for example, that that we can only punish for intentional harm causing, right? Because those desert constraints get in the way frequently, they get in the way of pursuing your favorite consequentialist goals, right? So you would tend to weaken the fault requirement of criminal responsibility.
So to be clear, is what you're trying to say that we would find under the consequentialist point of view that more people would end up being punished simply for the purpose of a desired outcome, is the idea?
That's right, and you wouldn't care so much whether they did it intentionally or negligently, or you wouldn't care so much really in the end, I think, whether they were responsible at all. For example, we have a defense now called automatism. So this person caused harm, but he or she did it while in a sort of an unconscious episode. Mm-hmm. He blacked out or something.
So like a possible defense, like sleepwalking.
That's right.
Would not
sleepwalking is a form of automatism. So on this view, this consequentialist view, why should that be an answer to a criminal charge? You know, if someone caused harm while he was sleepwalking, we would say, well, suppose he sleepwalks again and does it again. So the fact that he was not responsible would not be a reason for not subjecting him to criminal sanctions for these forward-looking goals.
Right.
So I'm saying that this consequentialist theory of punishment tends to collapse into the non-punitive approach to the criminal law that I spoke of just a moment ago. Okay, so that's the consequentialist or forward-looking approach of punishment. Now, of course, in contrast to that, we have the retributivists, you know, those who think that punishment is justified only by reference to what the criminal deserves. So it's backward-looking rather than forward-looking. But even within, it gets quite complicated, because even within the camp of retributivists, we can distinguish between two kinds of retributivists. One camp, which I tend to call moral retributivists, think that punishment is justified just when someone deserves it. That is, it's justified solely by someone's deserving it. Someone's deserving it is sufficient reason for punishing. There need be no end served by punishment, right? Mm-hmm. The criminal's desert is both a necessary and a sufficient reason for punishing. End of story. There's another kind of retributivism, which I call legal retributivism, that does insist that the criminal's desert constrain punishment, but it has no problem with saying that punishment is justified also by an end, namely, not the sort of ends that consequentialists talk about, that is, you know, prevention, protection, rehabilitation, not those sort of ends, but this legal retributivist would say that punishment is justified by the purpose of vindicating rights, human rights, against the denial of rights that's implicit in an intentional criminal act. So the point of punishment for the legal retributivist is to vindicate rights against someone who implicitly, by his or her action, denied rights. And so you have the desert constraint built into that purpose, right? Because you only have to vindicate rights against someone who denied them.
Right.
So the desert constraint is built into the purpose.
So it seems as though, with this view, what's being built in is a sort of attention is being paid to those who have been harmed in a way.
To those who have been wrongfully harmed, but actually, the legal retributivist is not concerned specifically with the victim.
Okay.
The legal retributivist views the victim as the concern of tort law, private law, you know, or a civil suit.
Right.
Where the wrongdoer actually has to compensate his or her victim.
Right. Right.
That's where the victim's rights get vindicated.
Addressed, yeah.
Within private or tort law, for the legal retributivist, the criminal punishment is concerned with vindicating human rights, not this person's specifically rights,
right?
Not, you know, Jack's rights or Jane's rights, but human rights. Because for the legal retributivist, the specific meaning of the criminal act as distinct from the tortious act, mm-hmm. is that there was a denial of rights by virtue of the intentional wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? If the civil wrongdoer, the mere tortfeasor, doesn't deny right. He infringes someone's right, but, you know, he might do so thinking he has permission, right? Or thinking he's
right.
Within his right. So he doesn't deny the right.
Right.
He acknowledges them. You know, he might take something belonging to you thinking it's his own. Well, mm-hmm. he doesn't deny the right. He just...
misunderstood.
That's right. Exactly. So, but the criminal, by virtue of his intentional wrong, he actually denies the right. And so for the legal retributivist, the point of punishment is to vindicate rights against the person who denied their existence implicitly. So that's the legal retributivist point of view, and that's the camp into which I fall.
I think that's excellent. It really kind of paints the landscape on this issue. Thank you. Okay, so another issue that I was thinking about is that we often hear of certain punishments being described as barbaric, or that there's some contrast between more or less civilized forms of punishment. Do you think that the progress of civilization involves a softening of punishment? And if so, why?
Okay. I do think that we can distinguish sensibly between barbaric and civilized forms of punishment. But I don't think the distinction is between harder and softer. You know, cutting off someone's hand for a theft would be, you know, excruciatingly painful for a relatively short period of time, whereas putting someone behind bars for 25 years, you know, might involve great emotional suffering over a longer period of time. And I just don't know how to determine whether one is softer or whether another is harder. So I don't think the distinction is between harder and softer. I think the distinction between what we call barbaric and civilized punishment tracks two other sorts of distinction. One is the distinction, I think, between inflicting suffering for suffering on the one hand, and inflicting an impairment of freedom for an impairment of freedom on the other hand. So in other words, I think the distinction is between the physical and concrete on the one hand, and the abstract and impersonal on the other hand. So for example, now, we no longer, in our punishments, we no longer inflict corporal punishment, right? We no longer try to inflict pain on the criminal for the pain, physical pain he caused. Instead, we interpret every crime, no matter what it is. It could be an assault, it could be a theft, it could be a murder. We interpret every crime as an interference with freedom of a certain grade of seriousness, an impairment of freedom of a certain grade of seriousness. And the punishment for that is an impairment of freedom of a certain degree of a certain quantity. Mm-hmm. Right, so no matter what the criminal does, we restrict his liberty.
Right,
it could be, you know, incarceration isn't the only way, but we restrict his liberty. That we take as the generic form of punishment for the generic kind of crime, which is a restriction of liberty. So the progress, I think, from the barbarous to the civilized, involves this movement from the concrete and specific to the abstract and impersonal. The other kind of distinction that the distinction between the barbarous and the civilized tracks is this, that we think of civilized punishment as ruling out certain interests that barbaric punishment views as legitimately furthered through punishment. So we think that passions like hatred have to be filtered out of punishment. So for example, we no longer punish people in the town square as a circus,
right,
where people can, you know, vent their anger, their hatred, or perhaps even perhaps even have their feelings of envy quenched by virtue of seeing how someone who has liberated himself from instinctual constraints, by seeing how they're treated, right? They can deal with their envy, perhaps, or whatever. So instead, we think of civilized punishments as ruling out of court those kinds of interests, and instead being concerned with the impersonal and impartial vindication of the rule of law or vindication of human rights against the criminal. So again, we have a move from the physical and the concrete to the, in a way, the metaphysical and the abstract and impersonal. I think that's how we should see the distinction, rather than between harder and softer, or more more or less lenient. And in that sense, of course, here too, civilization, because it does rule out these passions, brings its discontents, I suppose. So that may be an argument for providing an avenue for these passions in other ways that. And actually, victim impact statements might be a way of doing that. Which, as to whether this involves progress, I think it does, because I think the whole movement from the physical and personal to the metaphysical and impersonal, I think that's a movement toward distinguishing what the state does when it punishes from what the criminal did when he inflicted harm, right? It's a movement toward distinguishing punishment from the criminal's own force, right? So we want to distinguish it from the passions, from partiality, right? To move to an impartial vindication of law.
So if I understand what you're saying here, you're trying to say that a lot of the crimes that are taking place are coming from perhaps this area of passion, and we don't want to get into a sort of eye for an eye kind of scenario where the judging body is motivated by those very same things we're trying to...
Precisely.
Great. Okay, so, well, I think this sets the stage for my next question, which is the issue of capital punishment.
Yeah.
It remains a controversial issue in the States, but not in Canada. Do you regard capital punishment as justifiable? Much as the current federal government seeks to be tough on crime, they seem to have no appetite to revive this issue. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, of course, capital punishment is a very complex issue, and it can be approached from many different points of view. First of all, I think one has to sort out the question of whether capital punishment is theoretically justified, that is, whether it's theoretically right or wrong, from the question of whether it can be justified in the real world where death sentences are handed out. So, for example, you can have an unassailable theoretical justification of capital punishment in the abstract, but if it turns out in the real world that, you know, black people almost always get the death penalty for murder and white people almost never do, or that black people are always executed for murdering white people, but white people are never executed for murdering black people. If that's what's happening in the real world, then, you know, the actual system might be so irremediably corrupt that one would want to abolish it, or one would have to abolish it, whatever, even if it were theoretically justified. That seems to be a perfectly coherent line to take. The only alternative in that case would be to hand out the death penalty automatically on a conviction for murder with no discretion, right? To get rid of the discrimination. But in that case, you know, someone like Robert Latimer. Remember Robert Latimer a few years ago, convicted for murder because he killed his daughter who was suffering from cerebral palsy and was suffering terribly. He killed her to put her out of her misery. Mm-hmm. That person, Robert Latimer, would get the death penalty under a system where there was no discretion. So that can't be right either. Right. So if in the real world we were faced with a choice between discriminatory handing out of the death penalty, no room for intelligent discretion, or abolition begins to look pretty good, even if you have a theoretically foolproof justification for capital punishment.
Right.
Along sort of similar lines, you might say that even if the state does no wrong in executing murderers, still a practice of capital punishment is harmful to us. That is, we, you know, the society that inflicts capital punishment. It's just harmful to us because you might say, you know, it inures us to a practice of killing human life, and also to a practice of impersonally and coldly and, you know, killing human life. You might say that that sort of practice leads to the disvaluation of individual human life. So you might say that whether or not we do wrong in killing, still a practice of capital punishment does harm to our society, our culture. So that might be a reason for abolishing it. So now to come to the theoretical question, well, here again, you know, this is very complex and there are different standpoints. one standpoint is the consequentialist one, and it's the approach that I think gets discussed most in the public forum. The question is, you know, does the death penalty deter murder? And you know, I guess probably the answer to that is that there is no answer. No one seems to know. There's nothing. I mean, let's face it, a priori impossible to control for the death penalty over the same population or the same time period, right? So how can one ever be certain? From a retributivist perspective, again, one would have to distinguish between the claim that one ought to execute murderers because they deserve it, or and the claim that it's merely permissible to do so, but not obligatory. My own view, as a retributivist, as a legal retributivist, is to say that murder, very definitely, deserves the death penalty, but that the argument for establishing that also rules out the death penalty as in actual practice. So let me just explain that. So in the case of most crimes and most punishments, it's impossible to say what specific punishment a crime deserves. It's impossible to say that because we're dealing with incommensurables. That is, on the punishment side, we're dealing with a certain quantity of liberty restriction, 10 years, 15 years, 20 right. years. On the crime side, we're dealing with a certain quality of harm. You know, was it assault causing bodily harm? Was it death or what, right? Or theft, right? A property crime. So it's, we can never match, right? We can never know whether what specific quantity of restriction of liberty fits a certain qualitative impairment of freedom. With one exception, we know with absolute certainty, we know that the only penalty that equals an absolute extinguishment of liberty is an absolute extinguishment of liberty, right?
Right.
That we know for certain.
So this gives the theoretical grounding.
Right. But now, the fly in the ointment, though, is that although we know with certainty that murder deserves the death penalty, we do not know with certainty whether this person before the court in the prisoner's dock is a murderer. And so if the justification for the death penalty is our absolute knowledge that murder deserves death, then we can't give the death penalty in any case where we're uncertain whether this person is a murderer deserving death. But we are always uncertain about this because this is a, you know, whether someone is guilty or not, this is a matter of fact. There is no absolute knowledge about these matters.
Right. Which is why a matter of fact in the court of law passes as beyond reasonable doubt.
Right? That's right. Which is to say there's always doubt.
Right. Right.
Right. And on this theory, there can't be doubt.
Right.
So on this, theoretical justification for the death penalty being deserved for murder rules out the death penalty as a punishment for this person, because we must always have doubt about the matter of fact. So for that reason, I'm against it.
Fascinating. It's an interesting take. So I never really thought that somebody who's in support of the death penalty in theory could also sort of stand against it in practice.
There you
but
go.
It's quite a fascinating answer. Okay, turning a little bit to some more contemporary issues, the crime bill currently working its way through Parliament stiffens up punishment in various ways, including the imposition of mandatory minimum sentences for a variety of offenses. Probably many people didn't understand exactly what those are or how they compare with what we have now. Could you explain this a bit? And do you think the provisions of the bill, the current bill, are useful or not useful?
Okay, so we're talking here about the Safe Streets and Communities Act, and it did introduce some mandatory minimum sentences where they didn't exist before, and also increased the mandatory minimums over those that exist before, primarily with respect to drug offenses and to offenses involving the sexual misconduct toward children. So those are the main crimes around which these changes have occurred. So for example, incest committed by an adult with a person under 16 would carry a 5-year minimum, whereas now it carries no minimum. Sexual touching of anyone under 16 would carry a minimum 1-year sentence, whereas now the minimum is 45 days. Making or distributing child pornography would carry a minimum of 6 months instead of the present 90 days. And then with respect to drug offenses, trafficking in narcotics would carry a minimum 1-year term if accompanied by violence or done for a criminal organization. And it would carry a minimum of 2 years if it were done near a school, whereas now there's no minimum. So you see that we're not talking about major, major changes here, right? We're talking about, you know, a 1-year minimum if whether it was previously done, or you know, where there was a previous minimum of 6 months. We're not talking about huge shifts here. I know that this issue tends to be quite divisive in the political forum, but I think that's because the political forum is generally, you know, there's much more heat generated in that forum than in places like this, right? So now, as for whether these amendments would be useful, I have to say that I have no strong opinions about that. Because I think certainly the mandatory minimums that will be introduced would not be punishments that a court would view as disproportionate, right? Mm-hmm. You can't say that 1-year minimum for drug trafficking is disproportionate, right? So I don't think that these changes, you know, will be vulnerable constitutionally, right? So if they're not obviously unjust, then the only relevant questions to ask are, you know, what is the balance of cost and benefit, right? Mm-hmm. And so the question is, you know, whether the social costs of having more people in prison are a worthwhile price to pay for whatever benefits are achieved by marginal crime prevention. And you know, I think this is a political judgment that the government is entitled to make.
Right. Okay, so one of the other initiatives undertaken by the current conservative government in Ottawa has been the abolition of the Faint Hope Clause, which allowed prisoners to serve life sentences to apply for parole after 15 years, regardless of their sentence. What are your views on this?
Well, the Faint Hope Clause applied to those convicted of murder and who are sentenced to a term of life with eligibility for parole after 15 years. So the Faint Hope Clause allowed them to apply to the court, the Chief Justice of the province, to allow them to be considered for parole at the 15 at the 15-year point. Again, I mean, assume if 15 years in jail is not a disproportionate punishment for murder, and I don't think it is, then again, I don't think any question of penal justice is involved in whether or not to have a faint hope clause.
Right.
I don't think this is an issue of penal justice. There's no question that, to my mind anyway, that someone who murders deserves a life sentence.
Right.
So again, the only relevant issue I see here, the only consideration is whether, well, one consideration is whether the extra deterrent to murder that abolishing the faint hope clause will provide is worth, you know, having a population of prisoners with no incentive for good behavior in prison. So it's the problem of managing, you know, managing prisoners who don't have this incentive. So again, this is a matter of political judgment that the government, I think, is entitled to make.
Okay. Many of the arguments that you hear in the U.S. about the use of torture focus on the way it can be used to extract information. One sometimes gets the sense, however, that the driving force is really a desire to punish or to inflict punishments that would be legally permissible within the criminal justice system. Your thoughts?
Well, of course, I can't really speak about the motives of those who authorized, you know, the torture of the so-called enemy combatants. But it seems to me that it would not be rational to torture as a way of doing what would be impermissible as punishment, because torture is not a permissible way of extracting information either.
Right.
You're right, though, that these prisoners were, you know, called enemy combatants so as to put them in a legal void where neither the rights of the accused in a criminal trial would apply to them, nor the Geneva Convention for prisoners of war. So the idea was to put them in this legal black hole where they were completely unprotected. But actually, I don't think that there is such a legal black hole, a legal void. Prisoners have rights, and accused in criminal trials have rights because they have moral rights as persons, and those moral rights, the moral rights of persons, are recognized in various international human rights conventions, one of which is the UN Convention Against Torture, and the United States is a signatory to the UN Convention Against Torture. And so, as a signatory, it has a legal obligation to bring to justice, to try, and if convicted, punish those of its nationals who inflicted torture. So, as I said, I don't think there is a legal void into which the torture could fall, so that you could do it while trying to evade the injustice of punishment. I think there are norms applying to torture. The U.S. is a signatory to those legal norms,
and they have an obligation to follow that.
They have the legal obligation to. If its nationals were involved in that, they have a legal obligation to prosecute them.
So what do you think of the use of victim impact statements in sentencing proceedings?
Yeah, I think victim impact statements have quite an important role to play in criminal trials. First of all, I think they provide a channel for the kinds of emotions that are ruled out as the purpose of a civilized punishment, right? Mm-hmm. We spoke earlier of civilized punishment as involving this abstract and impersonal vindication of the rule of law and human rights and so on, and being dispassionate. Well, victim impact statements are a way of reintroducing the passions in a way that doesn't undermine the impersonality of the system, because the point of the victim impact statement is just to allow the judge to fine-tune a sentence whose parameters have been set, by reason, right, on rational grounds for proportionality and so on. So they just permit the judge to fine-tune. So here is where the repressed can return, as I said, without undermining the impersonality of the system. Another role I think victim impact statements can perform is this. We think that punishment, the legitimate use of force against someone can be justified and legitimate only if the reasonable person in the criminal shoes could see the justice of his or her punishment, could accept it as fair. And to ensure that the reasonable person in the criminal shoes could accept the punishment as fair, we have all kinds of constraints around punishment. Constraints on culpability, substantive constraints on culpability, for example, intention, responsibility, and so on. And also procedural constraints, he has to be presumed innocent, the Crown has to prove his or her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, he has a right to a trial by a jury of his peers, an open court, all that. All those substantive and procedural constraints are there to ensure that the reasonable person in the criminal shoes could accept his sentence as fair. But none of that ensures that this particular criminal can accept his punishment as fair.
And in fact, there's probably very good reason to assume they can't, given that they're in the position they're in many instances.
That's right. That's exactly so. So there's nothing so far that I've mentioned that goes to educating this criminal up to the standpoint of the reasonable person in his shoes, mm-hmm. right? So this is where victim impact statements can play a role, because by hearing the suffering he's caused to the victim, perhaps he can see what he's done and in that way perhaps be reconciled to the fairness of the sentence that he's about to receive. So it's a way, I think, victim impact statements are a way of closing the gap between the perspective of this accused and the perspective of the reasonable person in his shoes.
Interesting point. Great. Okay, so I have one more question for you. Are there any issues pertaining to punishment that you think should be on the public agenda or that should be discussed but are currently being ignored?
I think what usually does get discussed in the public forum are, questions about, the severity of punishment. So we hear about, governments that are tough on crime and governments that are soft on crime. And usually this is all about, what sort of sentences are being handed down and or provided for in the criminal code. But it seems to me, in Canada, where we don't have corporal punishment anymore, we don't have capital punishment anymore, all the changes that are being made, we spoke about this before with reference to the Safe Streets and Communities Act, all the changes that are being made, are fairly minor. I mean, whether a minimum sentence is going to be 1 year or 6 months, I mean, every country should have such troubles, right?
Right.
So that's what usually gets discussed. And to my mind, it's not really where the controversy really is. I think the real controversies rarely get discussed in the public forum because they usually are created in courts and in appellate courts. One issue of controversy is what constitutes criminality in the first place. That is, what level of fault or culpability is required to sort of get you even into the threshold past the threshold of criminality so that you're liable to punishment in the first place, right? So that's a real question. What's the dividing line between non-criminal action and criminal action? And I think the way the Canadian system, I think the where it draws that line is problematic, and yet no one really talks about it. For example, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that someone who is merely negligent, right? Not even grossly negligent, egregiously negligent, someone who is negligent in the same way that that someone liable for a tort in a civil suit would be negligent, that person, a negligent person, can get, under some statutes, 5 years in jail.
Can you, is there anything on the top of your head that you could point to as an example of?
There's an offense of misleading advertising where, you know, ordinary negligence in making a misrepresentation can get you, not necessarily, but can get you a 5 year jail sentence.
Wow.
So no one talks about that, right? People might also be surprised to learn that someone who commits a sexual assault under the mistaken belief that he had the victim's consent is lumped into the same category and liable to the same measure of punishment as someone who intentionally commits sexual assault, who sexually assaults someone knowing he has no consent.
Right.
Right. So again, that's a question of the kind of fault, the kind of level of blameworthiness that should get you into the category of criminality in the first place where you can be punished. So that seems to me an important question, and it's rarely ever discussed in, you know, in the press or debated in public.
No, I imagine in a lot of these cases, though, it's up to the judge's discretion. They take these kind of things into consideration, but it sounds like your point is saying that perhaps our legal system should have a more definitive answer on the books about these issues.
Well, that's right. For example, someone might think that someone who is merely negligent ought not to be categorized and stigmatized as a criminal in the first place. So that just isn't a criminal level of fault. And then on the issue of whether sexual assault, thinking you have permission versus knowing you don't, the issue of the lumping together problem,
yeah.
You're right that a judge might take that into account in sentencing. But if you think that respecting the difference between those two things is a matter of penal justice, if you think that lumping those two things together would be unjust because disproportionate,
right,
then you don't want to leave to a judge's discretion what is important as a matter of penal justice,
right?
You want to leave to discretion things that are indifferent from the point of view of justice, right? So I don't think the leaving it to discretion is a sufficient answer.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, many Canadians, I think, would be surprised to learn that you can actually be called a criminal and punished in Canada for thoughts.
Really?
Well, yes, because In the criminal law, there's something called an impossible attempt. So an impossible attempt is attempting to commit a crime, but where if you did everything you intended to do, it would not be a crime. So let's say, for example, that you were of a mind to carry out a money laundering scheme, but in fact, the money that you were going to launder was given to you by an undercover, police officer. So it wasn't. So to be guilty of money laundering, it has to be from money from the proceeds of crime, right? So let's say the money is from an undercover police officer. It's not the proceeds of crime.
Right.
So even if you did what you wanted to do, you wouldn't be guilty of anything, right?
Right.
It's not the proceeds of crime. You're just thinking that it would be. So under the laws that exist today in Canada, that person would be punished for an attempt, even though the only thing that would be culpable are The only thing that culpable is his thoughts. So people might be, surprised at that. And yet, have you ever heard of that being discussed
this
in
the
press?
First time,
There you go.
Count me among the surprised.
There you go.
Well, Professor Brudner, thank you for your time.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Decisions and Dilemmas. For more information about this podcast or the Center for Ethics, visit ethics.utoronto.ca.